The Sixth Amendment does not require a per se, if the lawyer gets on the stand, boom, that's a Sixth Amendment violation. That's not what the Sixth Amendment says. Instead, the analysis is that a Sixth Amendment violation occurs only if the testimony as a whole is prejudicial and materially interferes with the lawyer's ability to be a lawyer, to be counsel for the client, such that the counsel, or such that the client is effectively without counsel. That's the thrust of the Sixth Amendment, the right to be represented by counsel during a critical stage. And only if you're functionally deprived of that right by what counsel does is there a Sixth Amendment violation.
Welcome to the Supreme Court of Virginia podcast. This podcast is brought to you by Ben Glass Law, a personal injury and long-term disability law firm with headquarters in Fairfax, Virginia. Listening to oral arguments is one of the best ways to both learn and stay abreast of the substantive and procedural aspects of practicing law in Virginia. By putting these public domain recordings into the form of a podcast, Ben Glass Law has made it easy for the public to access these recordings. All commentary that is not part of the actual court proceedings is that of the show's sponsor.
Hey everyone, this is Ben Glass. Welcome back to the Supreme Court of Virginia podcast, Season 2, Episode 6. In this episode, we look at the question of when a defendant wants to come back later and withdraw his guilty plea, and his lawyer takes the stand to provide testimony in the court, is this a Sixth Amendment violation? I don't think the justices are having any of this argument, but I'll let you decide on that. All right, let's join the argument in process.
DeLuca versus Commonwealth of Virginia, Nancy Ellis, Appellant's Counsel, Graham K. Bryant, Deputy Solicitor General, Appellee's Counsel.
Good morning, Justices, Mr. Chief Justice. My name is Yancey Ellis. I represent Nicholas DeLuca, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
In the fall of 2020, Mr. DeLuca sat in a courtroom in Old Town Alexandria on probably the most important day of his life. It was during a hearing to withdraw his pleas of guilty. 6 months earlier, in March of 2020, he had entered pleas of guilty to 7 felony charges in Alexandria Circuit Court, and he was coming back to court asking to withdraw his pleas and exercise his constitutional right to go to trial. During that hearing, and during the most critical portion of that hearing, while his defense attorney was on the witness stand, Mr. DeLuca was not represented by counsel.
Wasn't he represented by counsel, by his defense attorney on the witness stand, advocating in his favor on the very motion that was pending before the court?
Well, sir, he was not represented by counsel in this aspect. His counsel was testifying, and I have some arguments on whether or not that was in his favor truly, but his counsel was testifying, and Mr. DeLuca was unable to question his counsel. He was unable to object to answers that his counsel was providing. He was unable to object to questions from the Commonwealth's attorney. He was unable, while he sat at counsel table by himself, to make a record of any kind regarding his counsel's testimony in that case.
So does this need to be a bright line rule? Anytime counsel is on the stand, that's it. He's without counsel.
No, it's not a bright line rule, sir.
So we have to get into the what counsel was really doing.
Exactly. I think that's correct, sir. And in this case, I think we need to be especially sensitive when what we're dealing with is a motion that calls into question the witnesses, the defense counsel's advice and representation of the client. And in this case, the exact advice that this counsel gave to Mr. DeLuca was the entire point of the hearing, whether or not he was appropriately advised or whether or not he was not advised. The judge never asked about this during their plea hearing. He asked about signing the plea agreement, but he never specifically covered his sex offender registration.
Can a lawyer representing a criminal defendant make a proffer of facts in exactly this context?
That's exactly what his counsel attempted to do.
But under your logic, can he?
Yes.
Okay, then what's the difference? A proffer is nothing more than suspending the oath, and you're making a statement, and the other side is conceding that the oath is not required, and he's making a factual proffer on behalf of his client. What logically or conceptually is any different from the same lawyer moving 4 feet further, sitting in a particular seat, and saying exactly the same thing, just under oath this time?
Well, Your Honor, I would say that he's still representing his client in the proffer situation. He's still standing by his client. He's still discussing with his client. He's still advising his client. Once he leaves his client, and I understand the court's argument about 4 feet, maybe it's only 5 feet. He's not with his client anymore. He's not actively representing his client while he's testifying on the witness stand. And there's no way for the client to shape that record and to make any type of, and again, this is part of the Commonwealth's argument and response, is this is speculative because we don't have the record of exactly what Mr. DeLuca wanted
to
present.
So while the proffer's going on, he can like nudge, the client can nudge his lawyer and say, no, that's not what happened.
Essentially, sir, yes, he can.
Well, why can't he just say, no, that's not what happened?
Well, again, he's at counsel table by himself. He's not legally trained. He's a layperson. He doesn't know that he's allowed to interrupt the court proceedings. He doesn't know that he's allowed to object to questions or specific answers. He doesn't know how to make a record. That's what his counsel is there for.
He was on the stand, right? And so he was able to give his version. I mean, I understand it's a little different because he's not asking questions, but he did have his say in this instance.
Well, Your Honor, I would say that the defense counsel had his say. And the defense counsel, the Commonwealth argues that what he said was helpful to Mr. DeLuca. I would say that it was vague and marginally helpful at best. And again, the motion had been filed in writing alleging, and if you read the motion itself, defense counsel doesn't say that he wrongly advised him. He says that my client says he did not have the right advice regarding his sex offender registry requirements. And Mr. DeLuca his counsel never argues one way or the other whether that was true or not, obviously because he's inherently conflicted.
So are you implying, sir, that when counsel went on the stand, he was actually acting in conflict with what his client either wanted or would have argued?
I think that he danced around the issue and he did not squarely address the issue while he was testifying, which is the only way for the circuit court to appropriately decide that motion.
So one follow-up on that, sir. So let's assume that you're right, and let's assume that he should not have gotten on the stand, that was all wrong. Was there not sufficient evidence, though, on this record at that hearing that the request to withdraw the guilty plea using the sex offender issue was really pretextual because he felt like he drew the wrong judge?
So I think that goes really to the heart of the motion itself, but I do not think there was a sufficient record, because had his defense counsel been able to speak freely about what his actual advice was to Mr. DeLuca, the court would have then had a set of facts where he was correctly advised or he was incorrectly advised, or we have a conflict of opinion between Mr. DeLuca and his counsel.
Wouldn't the recording, sir, almost by themselves have defeated the motion to withdraw the plea?
Your Honor, I would say that they do not. I understand the Commonwealth's argument. I think it does affect somewhat the good faith argument or the good faith element of this. But I think the fact that Mr. DeLuca, his thoughts on whether the victim still wanted to proceed or whether he wanted a different judge, while those could be true, it could also be true that he misunderstood his sex offender registry requirement. And when he's filing a motion saying that is the basis, I want to withdraw my pleas because I misunderstood my requirements, then that is the good faith that the court should be evaluating, is did he in fact misunderstand those requirements or not?
Can I circle you back to Judge Mann's first question, reading now from the Browning decision, in which the court said counsel, quote, took the stand to testify as to matters against his client's interests, end quote. Can you say that in this case, that the counsel in this case took the stand to testify as to matters against his client's interests, end quote?
I had two responses to that, sir. Number one, I would not say that it was in his client's favor. I would say maybe it was perhaps neutral in this case, but it was not helpful to his client because the ultimate issue was...
So the question is, did he testify as to matters against his client's interests?
And I guess our argument for the court, sir, is that's an ethical consideration. That's a matter of professional responsibility,
okay,
which the rule covers.
Let me give you back to the question. Whatever the consequences might be, ethically, Sixth Amendment, Constitution, Virginia Supreme Court, whatever, did he in fact testify as to matters against his client's interests?
I believe we could say that at best it was neutral. I wouldn't say it was directly against his client's interest, but it was not helpful in the aspect that it did not provide the court with any additional information on what advice.
Did he take the stand and testify as to matters indirectly against his client's interest?
So in that way, I would say that's a closer call. Your Honor.
What's the answer?
Well, the answer is yes, potentially. It was indirectly.
How against, so?
Because he did not squarely address the issue of the advice Mr. DeLuca received. He was inherently conflicted, and he didn't just say the advice. And by holding back, because of the nature of the proceedings and the fact that he was counsel and a witness in the same proceeding, he was not able to freely speak on that advice. And as a witness, he would not any longer have that obligation to advocate for his client at the same time. The fact that he's up there and he cannot speak freely on the issue is indirectly against his client's
interest. How do we know he couldn't speak freely on the issue? You've said that a couple of times. What indicates he could not speak freely?
The answers that he provided, ma'am, the answers he provided. He danced around the issue. He said, you know, he had this misunderstanding and I may not have corrected it. He asked me to verify it. I'm not sure if I verified it correctly. The issue, and the only issue, was, since this was the counsel that represented him during his plea, was, did you advise him appropriately on his registry requirements? That is the only issue of the hearing. And we have several pages of testimony that don't address that at all. Because the judge admittedly did not ask many questions. He preferred testimony, and so he directed counsel to the stand. He didn't ask many questions. The Commonwealth was focused on the good faith issues, and so we're left without a record here of what was the registration requirement advice that you gave to him. It was in the motion, but there was no testimony in support. And
if this lawyer had said word for word every single thing he said on the witness stand, if he'd said it in a proffer, no Sixth Amendment violation, is that the logic of your argument?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, the fact that he gets on the stand and he leaves his client's side where he can no longer advise and converse with his client during a very critical stage of his case, I think is the difference here. If when he does a proffer from counsel table and he speaks for a minute and then talks to his client and then maybe adds a few points as well, they're still working together. The client is still being represented.
As a factual matter, is there any indication he went back to counsel table and his client wrote him a note and said, you didn't say A, B, C, and D, and then he says to the judge, may I retake the stand and complete my testimony?
That is not in our record. That is not in our record, ma'am. That does not exist in our record. I can't say if that occurred or not.
Can you confirm, though, once this process began to unfold, can you remind us what the Commonwealth's position was on that particular procedure?
The Commonwealth's position was that Mr. DeLuca's counsel should not be a witness in the same proceedings during which he was representing Mr. DeLuca, which was probably the appropriate position. I understand the Commonwealth has a different position now, but I think that was the appropriate position on the day in question.
Is it because of the Sixth Amendment or because of the canons of legal ethics?
Well, I believe because of the Sixth Amendment, Your Honor. Just briefly on my second issue, I believe there's three reasons that the court abused their discretion in not allowing Mr. DeLuca to withdraw his plea. Number one, I believe that the court seems to have applied the wrong standard and not separating the elements of good faith and a reasonable defense. The court seemed to apply a standard of a good faith defense, which is not the correct standard to apply. I think the court also abused its discretion in not properly evaluating the prejudice element. The Commonwealth offered some argument, but offered no evidence whatsoever of prejudice. These events happened in late 2017 and early 2018. The plea happened in March of 2020, so there had already been a substantial period of time that passed. From the plea to the withdrawal hearing was only 6 months. Yet the court finds without any evidence that there was prejudice because of witnesses' fading memories. Lastly, I think, again, addressing the good faith argument, there was support in whatever vague statements that counsel made that Mr. DeLuca was not advised appropriately regarding his registry requirements. I understand the jail calls cut a little against that, but I don't think there's anything in the record that rebuts the fact that he misunderstood his lifetime registration requirement. And I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you.
This podcast is brought to you by Ben Glass Law, a statewide leader in the personal injury field. We help the injured and disabled make great decisions about their legal situations. Visit our website at benglasslaw.com or call us at 703-591-9829 for more information and a free evaluation of your case.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Graham Bryant, and together with John Marshall Fellow Rick Eberstadt at counsel table, I represent the Commonwealth in this appeal. The Court of Appeals of Virginia did not err in affirming the 7 convictions for child sex crimes that DeLuca incurred at trial. His argument on appeal that his trial counsel violated his Sixth Amendment rights by taking the stand and testifying fails as well because, as the Court of Appeals correctly held, at all times during this critical stage, this plea withdrawal hearing, Mr. Woolley, trial counsel, remained Mr. DeLuca's counsel, both nominally and in fact. A lawyer does not cease being a lawyer, whether he's giving a proffer or sitting on the witness stand. And here, the trial court did not require Mr. Woolley to testify. He advocated for his client, he asked to testify, was permitted to do so, continued to be an advocate while testifying, then stepped down from the stand, and continued to be an advocate while arguing the motion, which distinguishes this from the 2 key cases in the Court of Appeals, Owens and Browning. Indeed, had the trial court refused to permit Mr. Woolley to testify, we may well be here on a completely different Sixth Amendment problem, a violation of the defendant's right to present evidence in his own favor. This court should not reverse and thereby reward Mr. DeLuca for putting the trial court on the horns of a Sixth Amendment dilemma.
The trial court seemed to indicate that there was another way to do this, and that it appeared that it was defense counsel who wanted to go on the stand. Can you think of another way that defense counsel could have provided the court with the information other than getting on the stand and testifying?
Oh, that's correct, Justice Mann, that the trial court very much recognized that Mr. Woolley was driving this process. Mr. Woolley was the one that did want to get this before the court. Mr. Woolley at first wanted to put forth an affidavit of Mr. DeLuca, and the trial court didn't permit that. He also suggested that maybe we could do this as a proffer, and again, the trial court suggested that instead that the trial court allowed him to get on the stand. He didn't find that a proffer was appropriate. Of course, proffers may be appropriate in different situations. I think perhaps if there had been a jury, maybe a proffer might have been more appropriate. But ultimately, this is something that's in the trial court's discretion. And regardless of how many different ways that this could happen, what ultimately matters is, did what the trial court choose to let happen violate the Sixth Amendment right? And that did not at all happen here. The mere fact that the lawyer steps on the stand is not a per se Sixth Amendment violation. There's no authority for that proposition, and it's an unworkable rule precisely because it runs into another Sixth Amendment problem, violating the right to present evidence in your favor. Instead, the analysis...
But isn't the alternative, okay, now there's a conflict because the client is saying misadvice, so you appoint a new attorney. Of course, that causes delay and hassles. And then you have the hearing where he can be cross-examined and there's counsel there to properly examine whether the advice was correct or not, and the court can make a credibility finding.
So, Justice McCullough, I think that's certainly one way that this could play out, but it's not a way that the Sixth Amendment requires that it play out. A trial court could, looking at the totality of the circumstances, determine that, there's risk for substantial harm here. We're going to continue the case out for a couple of weeks. We're going to appoint another counsel. And then as former counsel, you can get on the stand. That would be a way to do it. I think that making a rule where that is the way that it must be done would be unworkable. And like I say, in some situations, could itself be a Sixth Amendment violation.
Sir, we've been focusing really on Mr. Woolley's testimony and what would be considered direct. But in this case, even though the Commonwealth objected to Mr. Woolley getting on the stand, the Commonwealth still cross-examined Woolley. Does that change the calculus in any way in terms of whether or not the Commonwealth could have essentially engineered a conflict with defendant and counsel?
Not at all. It's certainly not a per se that you cannot be cross-examined when the lawyer's on the stand. There are actually cases where
if you testify under oath, as counsel indicated, he kind of danced around certain things. But if the Commonwealth asked a question such as, you know your client is being untruthful and counsel is under oath and counsel believes that to be factually true and counsel says, yes, my client is being untruthful, does our calculus change?
Well, of course, in a completely different set of facts such as that, where you have testimony that on the whole is absolutely adverse, well then, yes, you've run into a Sixth Amendment violation. That's not at all the case here at all.
Was that, though, because we got lucky here?
Not necessarily. The reason is, when the lawyer's on the stand, we don't look to isolated statements by the lawyer and critically take them case by case. That's not what the Sixth Amendment requires. But when the lawyer's on the stand, it's as though he is also the lawyer and the witness. So on cross-examination, the lawyer gets to make strategic choices about whether to object, how to answer a question, things like that. That doesn't change just because the lawyer's the one on the stand.
So the
lawyer's
so
still
active. The counsel could have said, I appreciate the question, Mr. Commonwealth, but that would be privileged.
Exactly. If the attorney had chosen to evoke privilege, he could. But the fact that if the lawyer had an objection that objectively he could have made, but then chose not to make, just like other Sixth Amendment analyses, we don't second guess that strategic determination as long as it, you know, rationally could be a strategic choice. For instance, Mr. Woolley could well have determined that, let me get on the stand and be straightforward with the judge and lay out what happened, when it happened, even if maybe I could have objected, maybe I could have raised a point here, maybe I could have been a little bit more cagey, because the lawyer very reasonably could have decided that, look, the negative inferences that this judge is going to get if I get on the stand and then I start being evasive, that's going to be way more harmful than if I just lay things out. That will that's a strategic choice that the Sixth Amendment allows the lawyer to make. That's not a material interference with the lawyer's ability to serve as counsel.
It would have been quite ironic if the judge says, no, I can't take a proffer from you, counsel, and the guy says, well, if I have to go on the stand and put my hand up and take an oath, let's just move on, Your Honor. That would have ended the whole debate right there with most trial judges.
Absolutely. And I think part of this is that when these situations come up, they're going to be necessarily unusual situations. Lawyers don't generally wake up in the morning excited to go and hop on the stand for their client. So the trial court should exercise its discretion based on how it's seen the case develop, the relationship that it sees between the lawyer and the client, to determine is this appropriate, or whether there's a risk of a Sixth Amendment violation. And I think in sharp contrast to Browning and Owen, that the two Court of Appeals cases on which Mr. DeLuca relies, in those cases, the lawyer and the client walked into the room either outright not as lawyer and client, or to argue a motion to withdraw as counsel or for substitution of counsel. They came into the courtroom with inherent adversarial nature between them. Here, Mr. DeLuca and Mr. Woolley walked into the courtroom together. Mr. Woolley began the hearing on the motion to withdraw the guilty plea as his lawyer. He then remained the lawyer on the stand and then got off the stand, and in sharp contrast to both Owen and Browning, got up and then argued the motion to withdraw the guilty plea, the key thing that was here. In Owens, the Court of Appeals specifically found fault with the lawyer who came in for not arguing the motion that was the critical motion. In both of those cases, truly, the client was left alone without counsel. The court had granted the motion for counsel to withdraw, leaving him alone, and then only an unrepresented defendant was there when the court ruled on the motion to withdraw the guilty plea, which unequivocally is a critical stage when the Sixth Amendment right attaches. That's just simply not reflected in the case that we have here today. And one last point on the Sixth Amendment point. Mr. DeLuca suggests that maybe if we had another attorney to cross-examine Mr. Woolley, that Mr. Woolley might have provided better testimony. Ultimately, that's a speculative argument. And it kind of inverts the standard of review. At this stage, we view the facts, at least, in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, and along with the inferences arising from those. And the inference here is, I think, the same inference that we see in other Sixth Amendment contexts. Mr. Woolley was his lawyer and made decisions while on the stand as his lawyer to present the case as favorably as possible. The idea that maybe there could have been even more favorable testimony with more pointed cross-examination by other defense counsel, I think the applicable inference here at this stage is that it might well have been even more harmful, especially given the very difficult facts underlying the motion to withdraw the guilty plea, specifically the jail call and the was put before the court there. So just in the time that I have left, I'll briefly touch on the motion to withdraw the guilty plea. The trial court had listed several independent bases, any one of which is sufficient to justify denying the motion to withdraw the guilty plea. As the court has noted, the jail call is a very significant fact in this case because it provides evidence in the record from which the trial court very reasonably could have determined that there was not a good faith basis for the motion to withdraw the guilty plea. Similarly, in the Strong v. State case, Small v. Commonwealth case, this court recognized that prejudice against the Commonwealth was a valid basis for denying a guilty plea. And despite arguments to the contrary, the record clearly shows that had this gone forward, the focus on the minutia of the details, when these instances of sexual abuse happened, chapter and verse, what day, would have been a key focus of the defense theory. And as we saw, memories do fade over time, so the trial court properly relied on that. So unless the court has any other questions on the motion to withdraw guilty plea, the second assignment of error, the Commonwealth will rest on its brief with regard to that point. In sum, Mr. Woolley's testimony did not violate the Sixth Amendment here. Far from being prejudicial, he was on the stand as his lawyer supporting Mr. DeLuca's case. To refuse to have allowed Mr. Woolley to testify instead could have been a Sixth Amendment violation in itself. This court should not fashion a rule that incentivizes defendants to put trial courts on the horns of a Sixth Amendment dilemma, where no matter what the trial court does, there's a potential Sixth Amendment violation. Instead, this court should affirm the Court of Appeals' well-reasoned decision. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. You have 2 minutes and 17 seconds.
Thank you, sir. The Commonwealth argues that had Mr. DeLuca had a conflict-free counsel and been able to cross-examine his attorney on the stand, it might have been more harmful. It might have been more harmful. But at least then we would have known that we got it right, and we would have known that our system got it right. And I think that's the ultimate issue here, is if this young man is going through this type of hearing, and at a most critical stage of the hearing, when his attorney is testifying on the stand, he doesn't have an attorney to converse with, to direct the questioning, to make the record for his motion to withdraw his guilty plea, then we just can't ever be sure that we got it right. And so that's why an appropriate remedy, which we've asked for, could very well be sending this back for a rehearing on his motion to withdraw. Where he would have a conflict-free counsel and be able to cross-examine Mr. Woolley in a way that would probably leave no question whatsoever about what the right decision is.
If that were the right remedy, how do we get around the fact that in the jail call, it's pretty darn clear what he was thinking is, I don't want this judge. I want a different judge. I want judge shopping. And secondly, the victim, if I postpone this long enough, they'll give it. The victim will give up eventually. I just wait them out. I mean, that's right there in his own
There are those statements, sir, yes.
So, you know, if we're talking about fairness in the most abstract sense, and we should, of course, and justice in the most abstract sense, doesn't that offend both those concepts?
It does, Your Honor. I think those are conversations that he's having with a family member.
And they really have
no impact to his argument that he put forth in his motion into the court that he misunderstood his sex offender registry requirements. And I think both of those things could be true. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Please call the next case.
The proceeding has been a production of Ben Glass Law, a Fairfax, Virginia-based personal injury and long-term disability law firm. For a free evaluation of your claim, visit us at benglasslaw.com or call us at 703-591-9829.